Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is July 14th, 2006. Today's session is titled Creation Waits with Eager Longing, presented by Kim Winchell, number WI-KI 2006-03. Let's listen in.
So hello and welcome. I'm Kim Winchell, a diaconal minister for Earthkeeping Education and Advocacy in the Northwest Lower Michigan Synod. It's my first time here at Holden. I'm going home tomorrow, I'm sad. But anyone else here just new at Holden Village? Yeah. Anyone new today? Or have you been? Yeah, really? Wow, welcome. Lots of neat things to do here. Let me do a brief sort of summary of what's been going on with my sessions this week. I've been having a variety of topics and discussions about awakening people to God's call to us to care for the earth, something that I call awakening to God's call to earthkeeping. And with that, I want to mention that I'm working on a four-part study guide called that, Awakening to God's Call to Earthkeeping. I've got a sheet over here describing it. It's almost done. And there's a sheet here if you want to put your name and email address on there to be notified when that's available. The ELCA's stewardship program is planning to publish that once I finish it and we polish it up. It'll be a guide for congregational groups or any sort of groups to use. It could even be used over a weekend retreat. And it'll have, with each of the four sessions, it has options for expanding it if you have more time to go into things. Because I couldn't fit everything into just four sessions for the study guide. But today's session, as I mentioned, is called Creation Waits with Eager Longing. How do you share this message with folks back home? All week, I've been talking to people about ways that you might wake people up to this. On Monday, it was a matter of helping people rediscover their place in the whole cosmos. What is our place physically? And what does that say to us in terms of how we relate to the earth and to God? On Tuesday, we talked about creation spirituality. How do you connect with God's presence within creation, and how might that inspire your earthkeeping and empower it? On Wednesday, we talked about some of the biblical texts that you can draw from to support earthkeeping, basically, both from the Old Testament, New Testament. Things in the prophets are really helpful and can be read with an ecological lens, I think. Ecotheology is what that was about. On Thursday, it was a matter of prophetic anger, prophetic hope in terms of environmental issues. You know, it's easy to get really angry about all the issues going on out there right now, the things that are wounding and destroying creation. But where can you also look for some hope? You know, looking for modern ecological echoes to what was in prophetic texts in like Isaiah and Hosea and Jeremiah. Back then, the prophets would get after the people of God because they'd turned away from God. They weren't caring for the poor, the widow, the orphan, what have you. They were following, chasing after idols. And in those prophetic texts, there's always images, vivid images of the land itself suffering and the birds and the fish disappearing and things like that. So it's interesting to juxtapose that with ecological issues today and look for what is the hopeful vision that we would hold out today. Because prophets are not supposed to only critique, they're supposed to hold out a hopeful vision to move people forward. So, also last night at Vespers, that certainly wasn't a session per se, but that was in the context of worship, how might we lift up earthkeeping and sort of inspire folks. There's a whole lot of different ways to reach people of faith with this message. And there's a whole spectrum of awareness is what I've tried to point to back here. If you want to think, and I do, and the people I run across, no one's at the same place in this journey of realizing that caring for creation is an integral part of religious faith and witness. That's the premise that I base all my stuff on. So if here's a spectrum of awareness and action of our call to earthkeeping, on the real low end of the scale, I'd say there's the people that say, what, the church involved in environmental issues? That's political. There's no reason for the church to be involved in environmental issues. All the way to the other end said, hey, let's put a solar panel on the roof and a windmill out back. Let's bless the animals. It's a church that's doing almost everything it can do. There's everything all in between. So what I think I want to start with is asking you all, you know, where's your congregation at in this spectrum? Have they made that connection at all?
Well, at our church, they do bless the animals on St. Francis Day, October 1st or 4th, or third, usually fourth, the Saturday before that Sunday, or, you know, before that.
Do they do it inside or outside?
You know, I've never went to
Not that it matters, but I always figure the ones that don't do it inside are kind of chicken, because the animals are going to make a mess.
Well, I don't know if I'm going to tell you then. We do us outside.
No, that's fine. Yeah. The one that I've seen was outside. And what do you, how do people receive that? Isn't it, I mean, don't they really get happy and excited about it?
They do.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah.
And it is an act of outreach as well.
To the community?
Yeah.
Yeah, neat. What kind of scope of animals do you have, would you say, besides the dogs and cats?
And guinea pigs and birds and...
I've seen a snake and a
lizard. Whatever pets there are, I guess.
Yeah. But there's someone else? But where your congregation is on the spectrum? Are they even on the spectrum?
Well, my pastor is a great advocate for Holden, and he comes here all the time. He brought it back. His son went to the school here in high school, and so it's I don't know if we do very well at it, but there's an awareness of, you know, stewardship to the earth, until you said political, I realized that, you know, that can be so political. But at church, it's not. I mean, it's about stewardship. It's about being a good steward of creation.
Well, it can be political. I think it should be political, because in some ways, all our efforts can only do so much when there's policies at the national or state level that are, you know, preventing the right ecological things being done, you know, hindering action on global warming, for instance, or any number of things. So that's part of it. It's not only our actions at the congregation, but also the way we speak truth to power, you know, and bring our religious witness to bear in talking to our policymakers. Is there someone else?
We also, our church office recycles, and we have a couple of 10 or so passenger vans, and people are really urged to carpool to various places and activities.
That's wonderful.
I was going to say that I've just been at the church I serve as pastor since October, so it's all very new. But I observed that the coffee machine that you pay 50 cents to get a cup of coffee is using Starbucks coffee. But which might be okay, because Starbucks is starting to offer fairly traded organic coffee. But I doubt if anybody thought about getting it for the coffee machine. So I've raised a question or two. But we are using fairly traded coffee for other, you know, for the pots of coffee that are made. But we're using the Thrivent styrofoam cups,
because they're free,
which just really bugs me, and I don't know what to do about that. Maybe I've been here long enough where I can raise.
I've been the coffee person at my church for about 7 years, and I went totally with mugs, and Sunday, and I wash them up and clean them up, and I'm the only one that does it. If anybody ever takes over for me, they won't use them. They use the styrofoam cups. So I think that now that I'm not there anymore, they're probably using styrofoam cups.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is if it was something you could do on your own, or do you have people behind you?
It's something I did on my own.
Right.
And we have our custodian is very ecology conscious, and he started putting all these little curly light bulbs. Mm-hmm. And people complain because they weren't bright enough.
Oh.
And Pastor is making him change them all out.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. We're kind of low right now, I think.
Yeah. I'm wondering if someone can go ask the hammering person to subside for a while.
David doing that earlier, too.
Because they will sometimes go elsewhere with their carpentry if someone asks them. If they start up again, maybe someone can slip out there and ask them to. What you were saying, Gail, I think that points to one of the problems that I've run across oftentimes in talking to other people, that they're the one person, they feel like they're the one person in the congregation that cares or notices, you know, and that I think is a hard place to be, because how are you going to get anyone else to care or do anything or change? So one of the things I'll talk about later is the idea of forming a creation care committee or a green team or an earthkeeping committee. Because you really need a little core group of maybe about three people at least. And the pastor's support is helpful if not crucial. But let me see what else.
I think it also depends on what part of the country you're in.
It does, in terms of awareness.
I know up here, I mean, we're like the green capital of the world, and people don't realize until I can go back home to Virginia.
Yeah, oh, in the Northwest.
They're like, you're obsessed. You know? But I mean,
it's a way of life, right?
Yeah. So in our city, we do equal fair trade coffee.
It's like, why wouldn't you?
It's just a no-brainer, but I know it's not everywhere.
Right.
And it's, I don't want to use the L word, but it seems so
nothing's wrong with liberal.
It's exciting.
Yeah. Well, what I want to say too is, you know, wherever your church might be on this spectrum, I think the goal is to move it further along. Mm-hmm. So even if you're doing lots of things, it's like, what else can we do? You know, if you have this mindset that goes older. And just for a minute, maybe I want to talk about this too, because Christy, you raised this the other day, is what can individuals do? And there are certainly things that individuals can do. I think the reason I point more to congregations is because it can have a larger impact. If you can get a whole church doing something, not the whole church, but if the whole church, if the congregation building becomes more energy efficient, or things like that, or the opportunity to raise awareness through worship or study groups or, you know, those sorts of things, it seems like it would have a larger impact. But maybe even something helpful to do is to bring together a group of people and share ideas about what you're doing personally to care for the earth. And that's something we could do even right now. Just, you know, let's share some ideas about what you do right now at home. A lot of you probably recycle or whatever. Who wants to go through their list of favorite things to do at home to be ecologically friendly?
Yeah. I'm not that great, but I have a friend who went the whole ball of whack. Well, not to the hill, but they built a new house, and they paid the extra price for the low flow toilet and the whatever water heater is the green and the washer and dryer and the light bulbs and the whole thing, and the energy costs and the energy consumption is incredibly low, and whatever they could do, it was fun to watch them. It seemed like a lot of work,
There are some definite lifestyle choices you can make that have an impact.
And they live in a suburb. I mean, I know you could live out in the woods, but to not impact the earth so much with your asphalt and all that.
Yeah. Well, then I guess you're impacting the woods and the creatures, but in some ways.
The city that I live in makes it really easy to recycle. Uh-huh. They will recycle everything, and people don't have to separate anything.
Community.
And it makes it really easy, but not a lot, you know, I don't know, I think less than half people do it. But
see. So even when the choice is there, people don't do it always.
Bridges in Texas.
Yeah.
Well, our city is, recycling is a way of life, and we don't have to separate out too much, but they're implementing a system of kind of fining you if they find too many recyclable items in your garbage.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Huh.
Oh,
we've been warned, and it's not if they find two things, you get a fine or you have to pay more garbage. But our recycling is free, and so it's really an incentive.
There was a city ordinance in St. Paul where we lived for 23 years until recently. And we always knew that, you know, they could do that. They could find us if we were throwing stuff.
They go through your garbage to see what you did.
Well, when they're emptying it, if they see too many things repeatedly that could be recycled and aren't being.
We got charged by the, and it wasn't a city sanitation, but the, you know, garbage haulers, if we had put grass clippings in with the garbage.
Yeah,
which usually I didn't do, we would take to the compost, but if it sat there long enough, it became garbage, if you know what I mean. You know, because if it starts to decompose, it's really awful, so then I would put it in the garbage and we would be charged for it. That's not fined, but it was a disincentive.
our garbage in our township, the garbage disposal company, furnishes well, there's an ordinance that you can't put your lawn yard, like lawn clippings and bushes, you know, wheat or anything like that. You can't put it with the garbage anymore. So the garbage disposal company gave you a container, and if you don't have the container, you can't put it in plastic bags anymore. You need those paper bags. Otherwise, they will not pick it up.
Well, in addition to the yard waste pickup that we have in Seattle, they also now encourage you to put your kitchen waste in there, not meat, but any other kitchen waste, including, you know, the paper that you might use and such.
Gets
and
dirty.
All of that gets composted, and then the dirt is sold, or the whatever, is sold later.
Wow.
So it becomes then a way to enrich the city and enrich our lives.
And make some money to go back. Yeah, now see, that what that points to is the importance of policies, even at the local level, you know, whether recycling and composting is available, and then, you know, not everyone has that, but, and you were saying, you know, maybe 50% of the people participate in it. See, so here's another way that at the congregational level, you can spread that impact, because you can educate in your congregation about things people can do at home. Well, out here in the Northwest, you guys have a wonderful organization called Earth Ministry in Seattle. Has anyone heard of that? I've known of them for a number of years, and they just have all kinds of resources. Their website would be earthministry.org, and particularly for people in the Northwest, they form what they call congregational colleagues, I believe, and link the people together in a network, in essence, and they put on special programs for their colleagues, and even if you're not out here in the Northwest, you have access to their resources. Primarily, they have a couple of things that I'd recommend. One is some teaching modules for congregations called Caring for All Creation on the Road, at the Table, in the Home, I think it is. And it's like different units, kind of ways you can have a car-free Sunday, or, you know, special dinners, or things you can do in your home. They also have this resource book called The Greening Congregation's Handbook that's quite a large manual that talks all about this process of how do you introduce it in the congregation? Do you do it through worship? Do you do it through study? You know, what pathways might you use might fit with your congregation? They even have a questionnaire of how to assess where your congregation is now. You know, who are the power brokers, the gatekeepers? Mm-hmm. Where can you get an inroad into this? Because you can't do it all at once. And I wouldn't say that one size fits all in terms of what a congregation can do. It depends on where you're situated, a city, a rural area, suburban, even what part of the country. There's going to be different issues that are more pertinent to you probably. So there's no one size that fits all. There's no one thing that everyone can do. Well, maybe except energy efficiency. We can all do that. But you really need to go through, I think, that process of finding putting together an earth care team, ideally, of about three people. If you got more, that's wonderful. And have them just talk together for a while, you know, pray together. Talk about their experiences in nature, you know, what gives them joy in nature, what gives them pain in terms of what's happening with the environment. Spend some time deliberating together on what it is you feel God calling you to do and your church to do. And also, you know, get the resources and materials that give you suggestions and ideas, but it needs to be kind of a process, I guess, is what I want to say, where you discern what it is creation is waiting for from you with eager longing. I mean, you can do that in a personal sense. What is the Spirit calling you to do? But try and do it maybe in a group sense also. What is the Spirit calling our congregation to do, to move along this spectrum and to be better earth keepers? Well, I could go into some of the resources and things out there, unless anyone has any other questions or comments right here. Okay. I know you're not Lutheran, Mia Maria, but is everyone here Lutheran or in the ELCA? Because I have specific things for that. Okay. If you're not Lutheran, virtually all the main denominations have some kind of resource material, or even a denominational statement. In the early 90s, a lot of churches, after the 20th anniversary of Earth Day in 1990, they developed some kind of teaching or social statement or policy statement within your denomination. A place you could look To connect to that would be through the National Religious Partnership for the Environment, NRPE.org. That's a coalition group of four entities: the National Council of Churches, which would be the mainstream Protestant groups, the Evangelical Environmental Network, which is more the evangelical folk, the U.S. Catholic Conference, and the Coalition on the Environment and Jewish Life. So there's Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, you know, they're all under this NRPE.org umbrella. I haven't personally looked at their website lately, actually, but I heard it's being redone, so it's supposed to be even better now. For mainstream Protestant denominations, the National Council of Churches one is a good place to go, nccecojustice.org. See, I didn't have handouts today because I'm saving on paper. I'm being ecologically responsible. But there's really just a few key websites that'll take you into everything you'd want to have, really. I mentioned Earth Ministry, another one that's kind of the one-stop shopping place for everything eco-theological would be the Web of Creation. And that's just like that, webofcreation.org. That's based in the Lutheran School of Theology at Chicago. Professor Dave Rhodes there has been doing this kind of work for like 20 years. He's got a campus green zone and just a really cool guy. I fondly refer to him as the father of the Web of Creation. I've told him that. But within that website and that program, they have something called the Green Congregation Program. And that's a link right off their website, and it tells about all kinds of things. Again, a process by which you can form a group in your congregation and the things you might do from that. Another one that's might be of interest to you if you want to emphasize some worship elements is a website called seasonofcreation.com. In Australia, a fellow developed entire liturgies for four Sundays that he calls the Season of Creation. It's the last four Sundays of Pentecost is when he fits that in. And there's one, I think, that focuses on forests, water, land. I forget the other one. But some folks here in this country, I think Dave Rhodes and Paul Santmeier, have reworked it for American audiences. So they have an American version on there. It's the full setting. In fact, there's two settings, I think, for each Sunday. One that's a little more formal, and one that's maybe a little more contemporary, but it's the hymns, the prayers, you know, everything. So you'd want to look for the American version, and it's a PDF form that you can download for free. So, or even if you didn't want to do the full service that way, you could certainly take elements from it, prayers or hymn suggestions, sermon ideas, those sorts of things. And for the non-Lutherans here, through the nccecojustice.org, nccecojustice.org, that would have links probably that would fit for any denomination. I think it does. It has a link to denominational statements, as I think about that now. So if you can, which denomination are you, if I could ask?
Episcopal.
Oh, yeah. Episcopalian's got lots of stuff going on. They're even ahead of the Lutherans in some ways. There's an Episcopal priest, Reverend Sally Bingham, who started the whole idea of interfaith power and light organizations. Have you heard of her? Okay, she was based in San Francisco at Grace Cathedral. But she has seeded efforts like that all across the country. There's, I think, I want to say 17 states that have a religious organization called, you know, an interfaith power and light. Like in Michigan, there's Michigan Interfaith Power and Light. And to connect with that in your own state, you'd want to look, there's probably two places you could look. The first would be Reverend Bingham's organization, which is called the Regeneration Project. And the website is theregenerationproject.org. And that will have a link to state IPLs, Interfaith Power and Light groups. What those groups will do for their member congregations, and in Michigan, it's like $100 for a congregation to join. The way it works there is the congregation gets an energy assessment that lays out a report for them of steps they could take, how much it might cost, how much energy savings they might see. You know, it's a pretty comprehensive report that they get. They also get access to educational materials and like support. You know, there'd be someone from the IPL that could come and talk to your congregation or parish. So that would be a place to check out. Let me see. For Lutheran folk, there's a couple of things. There's our social statement from 1993, Caring for Creation, Vision, Hope, and Justice, that probably most people in the pew don't know even exists, but it's something you could use in a lot of different ways. There is a 4-page study guide, I believe, on the ELCA website, probably elca.org/environment, I think would direct you to the 4-page study guide. Or just take pieces of it and put it in your monthly newsletter, you know, or even your own, I'm sure your own denomination has materials that you could draw from and put a little blurb in the monthly newsletter or you know, bulletin for Sunday. I guess the point I'm trying to get across is there's a wealth of resources out there, especially compared to in the early 90s when I was first involved in this work. There's countless books and, you know, liturgical materials, worship materials, Greening Congregations Handbook, Green Congregation Program from Web of Creation. It's all there. And there's a couple of videos that are real good, too, that are each a half hour long. These are worth maybe looking into for your congregation. The one that I think is the best all-around educational piece to use with people of faith to start making that link between environment and faith is called Keeping the Earth, Religious and Scientific Perspectives on the Environment. And afterwards, if you want, I've got a sheet that lists all these if you need to check what you've written down. The Keeping the Earth video came out in, I think, 1993 or so, but it's still really helpful. It has a number of scientists and a number of religious leaders all speaking about care of the earth. Scientists approach it as the biosphere. The religious folk from a variety of religious traditions, including Jewish, talk about it being the creation. But it has these wonderful nature images and narrated by James Earl Jones. It opens with these beautiful images and James Earl Jones reading the creation account from the beginning of Genesis. It's just even that alone gets you stirred up, and there's, you know, whales jumping and dolphins and music, and then it goes into, I'll just share this with you because Marie and I have been there. It was too cool. At the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, Episcopal, huge place in New York City, they do an annual blessing of the animals. Have you been there or heard of it?
We do one too.
Pardon?
We do one.
Oh, yeah. Well, this one, that cathedral is huge. It's this giant Gothic-type cathedral in New York City that does a two-hour creation liturgy for a St. Francis festival. And it's just filled with people and their pets and the high point is at the end of the service, they bring in a procession of animals, large animals, a golden eagle, a camel, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Maria, you want to talk about it a little bit? It's just...
Oh, well, I mean, even the whole liturgy is, they use the Mass of Creation, Paul Winter.
Yeah, Paul Winter Consort.
That was huge. Mm-hmm. So the music is just absolutely wonderful, and they have dancers and that carry these streamers that swirl around, and it's just, and they have one section, and people bring their own animals to church. So you have dogs and cats and bunnies, and there was a little girl in our pew that had a hermit crab. She carried in this little case, you know, and then they sectioned off a section for people with large dogs. So you have these, you know, huge dogs come in, and it was funny. I mean, you would think with dogs and cats, you know, you'd have a mess right then and there, but not at all.
No.
You know, there was an occasional bark, but it was really the animals even were, you know,
quieting themselves in church.
Well, they well, they seem to appreciate it.
They really, and then when the procession then started, and of course, you were not allowed to take any flash pictures, you know, I mean, then you couldn't go and pet the animals. They were sort of, they had dancers and that, or young.
Yeah, liturgical dancers.
They just sort of stood there so you couldn't get out of it.
So the animals wouldn't get distressed coming down the aisle.
Yeah.
But they go down there, they're blessed by the presiding bishop, the bishop of that diocese, and then as they go out, and I think the clergy all follow the animals, and the musicians follow them, and it all spills out onto the street of New York. It's just this tremendous celebration. The reason I raised it, though, it's in that video. A piece of it is in that Keeping the Earth video, just enough to give you a taste of it. In fact, that's where I had seen it. It's like, I got to go there someday. But it's just, you know, it's like 5 minutes long or so in the video. The entire video is on a half hour long, but there's just stirring images in that video that people will talk about. I mean, there's the elephant in the video that's swaying to the music that the people are singing. And they make the point also, the scientists make the point that we really need to do something about what's happening to our environment. And the people of faith also really powerfully make the point that this is a calling for us. So it's a real helpful and emotionally moving, I think, video. And that's part of the issue, I think, in terms of getting people to care about caring for creation is you can't just give them facts, I guess. It can't just be a head thing. It's got to hit them at the heart level somehow. You know, whether you can start to do it through a video, but maybe you need to get them outside and do some kind of a worship service outside or a creation spirituality retreat, you know, with the women of the church, and then from them take a group to form the Earthkeeping Committee, whatever. But and through worship, I think you can do that. Last night with the old turtle story, you know, that can get people through the heart too. The way we did it at my church once, some years ago, was to take a bunch of young children, and they each had one creature, one line. It's like there was an ant, there was the blue sky, there was this, there was that. The blue sky girl had like a blue sheet she held over herself. We're talking rudimentary costumes. But they were lined up all across in front of the altar, and either someone in front, you know, had a little sheet to give them the words if they needed, or they had it written down on the back of a picture they were holding, like the mountain, you know. The kid had drawn a picture of a mountain and had the word back there. So they're lined up, and then you have the narrator maybe in the lectern and someone being Old Turtle in the pulpit, you know. You go through the story that way. And the point where the animals are having an argument, say, they can all talk at once, no, God's near, God's far, you know, get them all at once, and Old Turtle, no, stop. Likewise, towards the end, where, you know, the earth is dying, the trees are dying, all that, and there's that voice that says, please stop. If you have all those little kids say it at the same time in their plaintive little kid voices, please stop, and then sink to the floor, you know? You got to move some hearts doing that. you just got to. And it doesn't necessarily have to have a little reflection afterwards. It can just go from Old Turtle right into When Long Before Time, you know? Or just have a few moments of silence even, and then go into When Long Before Time. And that's got to move somebody, you know? So there's lots of creative ways you can try to get into this. All right. Come back to my list here. So there's resources out there. There's denominational networks. Oftentimes, within the ELCA, we're trying to build a viable Lutheran Earthkeeping network of the synods. So that's something, if you're interested in that, you can talk to me afterwards. We're hoping to have like a contact person in each synod. I've been a part of a group that's sort of a steering committee for that, but we're still working on fully fleshing that out. Another video that's kind of useful in terms of climate change, particularly energy use, it's produced by the folks that support these interfaith power and light groups. It's called Lighten Up. And that's also at the regenerationproject.org. It's about $15. You can email info@theregenerationproject.org and ask about the Lighten Up video. It's basically just Reverend Sally Bingham driving around her Prius, stopping at various places and talking about biblical texts and putting that against climate change type things. So that might appeal to people also. It's more an educational thing, I think, than a thing that grabs the heart. Any questions or comments on some of this? Are you aware of any of these things out there before, or groups, or someone said they'd heard of Earth Ministry, but by and large, were you unaware that those sorts of things were out there, would you say?
To that degree, yeah.
Yeah.
It's much more prevalent than I thought it was in terms of resources.
Yeah, just even looking at the web of creation, you couldn't even look at everything on that website. I've not seen everything on that website. All right, well, let me talk a little bit about how it might work if you had a green team in your congregation. Particularly in both the Green Congregation program on the web of creation and Earth Ministries Greening Congregation handbook lay out a process for you. I've kind of summarized some of the points of that. The first is to bring together these people in some way. Maybe have a question in your congregational newsletter or something. Is anyone interested in forming this committee? Is anyone concerned about creation and wants to approach it from their standpoint of their faith? You know, put the pitch out there in some way, or show the video and ask for people afterwards. The Keeping the Earth video. So the first is to pull together the group, and then decide, you know, what kind of structure, the basic stuff. How often do you want to meet? How do you want to communicate with the rest of the congregation? How do you want to have representation from different aspects of the congregation? Someone from the worship committee, maybe. You know, let the pastor be apprised of what you're doing. Someone from the building and grounds committee, maybe. You know, think about what people need to be on that group to make it most helpful. So you set a group consensus on how to proceed, how you might want to set priorities. You find it helpful to develop a mission statement, maybe, of your purpose for being. You know, just even a one-sentence thing. And then share that with the congregation regularly in maybe a monthly little article or something. And then what's helpful, I've heard, is to come up with an annual plan that sort of brings that mission statement to life, that sentence you've written. You know, make some goals for the year and make them and have them be modest. You're not going to do 10 things, you know, maybe 3. Maybe you'll have a blessing for the animal service, or maybe you'll have a carpool Sunday, or set up an ongoing carpool for the congregation. Just whatever fits for you all. Come up with a, you know, short list of goals. You might want to look at, and this wouldn't have impact right away, but you might want to look at where you could impact the language of your congregational mission statement. Is there anything in there that says that you're going to include care for creation in what you do and preach and you know, those sorts of things? What might you do in terms of the church building and grounds? You know, plantings or an energy audit or whatever. What sort of community outreach might you do? By that I mean both maybe a blessing of the animals that would invite people in, but are you going to, could you host a forum for a candidate, say, or two candidates, you know, and invite other, when you do those sorts of things, you have to be careful because of nonprofit issues. Mm-hmm. But if you collaborate with other groups, maybe the, who am I thinking of? There's a women's group.
League of Women Voters.
Something like that. A group like that, you know, maybe offer to use your church as a place to host it. And have some other groups too. And then have a variety of questions, but make sure you ask the environmental policy questions too. Especially with an election year coming up. It's a good opportunity for that. Or have Advocacy Sunday for your church. Some of you might do that already. But have a board up there of what are some pertinent issues locally, at the state level, nationally. A little bit of information for folks, and then give them the addresses of where they can write. And environmental groups, and even denominationally, through like a Lutheran Office of Governmental Affairs or whatever for Episcopalians you have for public policy, if they're addressing a certain environmental issue, they'll probably have talking points you could use or sample letter points. Because the advocacy part really is important too. And that might be something your group in your church would want to promote. So you come up with an idea of the sorts of goals you have for the year, and then what you want to do is maybe involve other people in the congregation, let them know that you're doing that, and engage them to help you, you know, collaborate with you in achieving these goals, whatever they might be. And then at the year's end, look at what you've done or tried to do and evaluate it. Celebrate what has happened, let the congregation know, we're celebrating, we did this and this, you know. Are there ways to do things better? What worked, what didn't? You know, and then make goals for the next year, basically. So it can be an ongoing process. I think what happens often in congregations is it's a one Sunday thing. You know, they do their blessing of the animals, or they do an Earth Day Sunday, and then the rest of the year is just gone. So ideally, along this spectrum and in terms of having the best impact, you want to weave this earthkeeping ethic throughout the life of your congregation. I'd say that's the ultimate goal. So that it's not an unusual thing, that it's not just a one Sunday a year, that it's something that comes up in worship or in how you do coffee hour or, you know, how you plant a garden and share it with a soup kitchen or something. There's there's just countless ways it can be done. Any other comments, reflections here? I've come to a mental blank for a moment.
Say, I just don't know if it really makes that much difference if I
could
drive somewhat less or change light bulbs to halogen or any of those things.
I'm glad you brought that up. A couple of things. First, it all adds together to make a difference. I think I was talking to you ladies the other day about this. A natural metaphor that taught me about that one time, a lot of years ago. I was at a conference where I'd heard all these wonderful speakers and learned a lot. And before I left, I felt an urge to go and listen to the land itself. I was in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And one of the workshops I'd gone to was a Native American woman, a Cherokee woman, talking about how the land teaches us. So I went for a walk before I left on my plane, and What lured me was the sound of a brook coming down this mountainside. And I just was going open, you know, and going wherever I felt pulled to go. And I went and sat down by this brook and just sat there waiting to see, you know, what would happen. And I got to looking at the roots coming into the side above this brook. It was like a spring coming out of the mountainside and coming down. And there was the water and you could hear it. It went down the hill quite a ways. But there were like individual droplets coming off these rootlets. You know, I started thinking, you know, that's about how it seems sometimes. We're just one little drop in the whole scheme of things, and how do we make any difference? But all these drips coming together, you know, into that stream had a sound that was heard. And even water can wear away rock, you know, when there's enough of it moving along. So I guess if you can give people the sense that it's part of a stream, it's part of a movement across the country that we add to. It's like a wave we're all adding to.
Is it fair to say that that recycling has made a difference?
Yeah,
I mean,
so.
It takes energy to recycle. I always think about those grocery bags that, you know, the grocery store won't take back, and you never remember to take them yourself when you go shopping. So you just keep piling them up, and all you can do is recycle them or take them someplace where they need bags, but you know, it's likely.
Yeah, what if you were to find somewhere and sell at your church cloth bags, shopping bags?
Yeah.
I have some cloth bags from 1990. They're a little raggedy, but our local grocery store, in honor of...
You forget to take them.
Well, keep them in your car.
Well, I always think about, you know, so I collect these and then I put them in recycling.
Yeah.
They're going to be made into more bags.
See, I avoid plastic bags most of the time.
No, I'm talking about the...
Paper ones.
I avoid the plastic too, and actually our grocery store recycles plastic bags, which I think is a really great thing.
I use cloth bags until I need a paper bag to put my newspapers in.
Oh,
but and they know me by my bags at these stores, because almost no one brings bags, but some have had to get new handles, some have got holes, but I keep them in the car, you know, and I take them in when I grocery shop, and I hang them on the doorknob. After I load the groceries, they go on the doorknob, so I put them back out in the car.
It is the success of recycling, which, you know, I mean, I can remember when nobody did it, and now lots of people, maybe most people in America, I don't know if that's true.
I wouldn't say most, but the percentage has increased quite a bit.
It's fair to say it's made a difference.
Yeah.
That would be an example of the little droplets of water.
I think we can't always see where the difference is made. It's like putting a pebble in a pond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to ripple out, and you don't know where all those ripples go.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to say back here?
I think where recycling has worked is with you individually. I think the point is not, I mean, the peripheral point is, how am I thinking differently?
Mm-hmm. That's
so
a good point.
I mean, I think in our state, in our little town, they don't even recycle glass. Only plastic with one or two written in it.
Yeah.
And, but our children living on the West Coast are vehement recyclers by law.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been good for us.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good point, that it is kind of a, it helps start changing your mind. It's almost like a formation process in a way. And when you do one thing, you might do something else. Like at our house, we recycle, of course. We put a lot of stuff up to compost. We have a number of compact fluorescent light bulbs in different lights. Oh, goodness, what else do we do? Some of it's so natural that I can't even bring it to mind anymore. We have garden spaces. We have organic gardens.
But it begins with...
It does. It begins with one thing, and then you feel called to do other things. In our community, in the summertime, they spray malathion for mosquito control. And we live out in the country anyways. Part of our property is a half mile deep, you know. Many years ago, in fact, when my youngest daughter, who's now 20, when she was about 10 months old, our house sits back from the road a little bit, and the mosquito truck was coming down the road, you know, hosing everything with malathion. My husband, actually, this is kind of funny, he looked out the front picture window. This was after dark, but he presented an interesting finger to the truck driver as he went by. I was at work, so I heard about this afterwards. But the truck driver stopped out front, backed up, drove up our driveway, and started towards the house. This was probably in August. The windows were all open. My husband closed down all the windows. And for people in the city, this malathion is just totally rolling in their screen windows. We'd always run through the house when I lived in the city and close down the windows because that stuff would come in. It's an organophosphate, you know? Sure, it kills mosquitoes, but I don't want it on me either. And it kills all kinds of other bugs. But when that happened, I called someone up the next day to complain, and I said, you know, you can't do that. You know, and they said, well, you know, there's a program to opt out of the spraying if you'd like. Of course, they don't publicize that. Mm-hmm. But, like, beekeepers do that. Mm-hmm. And what we got back then and still have now, and every year we have to let them know again that, yes, we want to keep our no-spray signs. We have, like, reflective signs on the borders of our property. So when that truck is coming along, it turns off the sprayer as it goes past our house and then turns it back on. So that's like a statement type thing, too, you know. In the summertime, you're going to have mosquitoes. If it's rainy, you're going to have a lot of mosquitoes. If it's dry, you're not. You know, their malathion really isn't doing much, I don't think, to the mosquito population, other than making things resistant to it and killing beneficial bugs. But the other thing, Christy, I wanted to bring up when you were talking about when people say, does it make a difference? Because this is another piece on my outline that gets at this creation waits with eager longing piece, and the spiritual part of it is... I think a lot of the reason people don't get more involved in environmental stuff is apathy. Well, it's ignorance and apathy. Those two kind of go together. If you don't know, you don't care. If you don't understand the issue, you're not going to care. But also there's the apathy of it's just too huge. You know, how can I make a difference? It's so overwhelming. Why should I even try? You know, why should I get involved? It's kind of the overwhelming sense of it that makes people apathetic or indifferent. Or trying to shield themselves from hurting about it. But something I heard years ago that, you know, I thought was a key insight was that if you look at what the opposite of apathy is, you know, linguistically even, and in feeling, do you know what the opposite is, the direct opposite? If apathy is in Latin something like apatheia, lack of feeling.
Pathos.
Yeah, or compassion. With feeling, or the way this woman described it was to suffer with. And I think in German, right, Mitleid, it's more that sense that compassion is to suffer with. That was an interesting sound. And the point is, when you can allow yourself to suffer with the pain of creation in some way, when you can do that and you know, be open to how God's Spirit will touch you, it's like you become a channel for God's grace to work through you in some way to direct you to something that you are able to do within what you might say your sphere of influence, in your church, in your home, in your job, at school. There's something there that you could do. For instance, something that really wounded me to my core a lot of years ago was the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. I'd been born in Alaska and grew up in Michigan, but I always had this sense of spiritual connection to Alaska. And when that happened and I saw those images on TV, at first I didn't understand why I was grieving so much about it, but it was like that's a desecration. it was like a sacred place to me. And it just made me really hurt. And it's like, God, how can that happen? What can people do about it? I think was kind of how I was feeling. But in essence, what you're asking there is, how can I serve you? You know, what can I do? And I couldn't go to Alaska and clean up the oil. Even the people there couldn't get it cleaned up all the way. But I could start a paper recycling program at my workplace. You know, I could get involved in my community in our volunteer recycling group. And when you do those sorts of things, when you engage in those sort of things, it's like there's some joy to counterbalance that pain. Some of you probably have heard this Frederick Buechner, I think, quoted is, that the place you are called to is the place where your deepest joy meets the world's greatest need. And that's through attention to what is it that gives you pain, I think. But it can work in terms of ecological issues too, in some manner. So that's what, in a spiritual sense, I like to use that text, you know, of creation waiting with eager longing. You know, what's creation looking for from you? What is it you can do? And you might not be able to name for your whole church what it is creation is looking for, but what's creation looking for from you? You know, maybe help in forming that committee or whatever.
Yeah. Kim, I was at your session yesterday.
The prophetic one, right? Is it the prophet one?
We teach our children these things. And at lunch today, we were sitting with a woman and her two children who just came in to Holden Village for the first time. And the children left right after lunch to go do whatever they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me at that moment that what I could do is tell this woman a couple of the facts that I heard day before yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
One being that if global warming continues, that possibly 30 years from now, the glaciers here will have melted and there will not be drinking water, and there will not be water for power, unless something intervenes.
Yeah.
And she was just silent for a moment. She looked kind of stunned. And I said, so tell your children about this.
Uh-huh.
They need to know now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a place where they are and they can relate to it. It's not way off there somewhere that they may not be able to bring their children here.
Exactly. That's a good point. And she, as a mother, ought to feel moved to do something for her children, so they can continue to enjoy this sort of thing.
So as simply as spreading a little bit of the news.
Yeah, put a pebble in the pond.
That's how we can help.
Yeah. Another thing too, let me share this little story with you because I thought this was just really cool. I was coming back from having been out at the Labyrinth, and as I was coming down the road, there was a family up ahead of me and some little children. And they all started going, ooh, you know, and they're looking at something on the ground. And I thought, okay, what, there's a bug there and they're going to step on it. Because I have this thing about you don't need to kill every bug you see. You know, if it's not really hurting you, just put it back outside or put it where it needs to go. It's one of God's creatures too. So I had fears that they were going to torment some creature, or some bug. But that's not the case. The dad apparently picked it up. It was one of these big beetles, kind of black with a huge antenna, very striking. The dad had picked it up, put it on the little girl's hand, and she must have been like 4. She was quite small. And she was so cool about it. And he said, oh, it must love you. She's like, oh, I have it on my hand. You know, and I didn't know what it was she had on her hand at first, so I actually ran to get up to her because I thought, I want to take a picture of this little girl with whatever it is on her hand because she's delighting in it. So I did. I'll show you later, Maria. So she's just like, you know, she's got this big old beetle on her hand. I said, I'm going to show this to the big people who are so afraid of bugs, they squish them right away, you know. But then when I said, you know, God really is happy when people are gentle with his creatures, you know, or with God's creatures. And what you ought to do is gently put this, I said, but a lot of big people are probably afraid of bugs. And if you put it in the wrong place, they're liable to step on it. So why don't you put it over in these flowers, you know, so it has a place to hide. And she was so sweet, you know. Mm-hmm. But that's the sort of thing, too, with kids. You know, you can encourage them to not fear nature, to delight in it, you know.
Yeah.
And kids naturally do oftentimes take delight in it, but I think that's something we really need to encourage and affirm when they do that.
I'm thinking about how maybe it's just a no-brainer, but to use VBS curriculum or develop VBS curriculum on creation subjects. We have a preschooler kind of church, and they had, it was not a free VBS, but a kind of a science camp for 3 weeks, and one was on something about mud, another one was on rocks, and another one was bugs. And, I mean, that could be done all kinds of ways.
Totally,
summer to summer.
Yeah. There was a Augsburg Fortress piece out, I want to say in 1994 or 5, called Creation Celebration. Mm-hmm. That had the music and the teaching things. It might have been too, flashy. I don't know. Because you could just make one up. There was a church locally to me that did that this year with joined with a Methodist church, I think, but they wanted to do a creation-themed VBS, and they invited me to come and consult with them, so I gave them ideas, and I suggested that when they were done that they ought to write down kind of what they did, and I would try and let other ELCA congregations know that was out there. Mm-hmm. I would think in the Episcopal Church, too, there's been groups that have done a VBS-type program. Yeah. Well, we're down to our last couple of minutes, so I've got a really neat poem/prayer here. You've heard this before, Maria, that's a good way to end in terms of what kind of efforts we want to do in our churches. This is called Ministers to the Future. It's by the late Archbishop Oscar Romero. It helps now and then to step back and take the long view. The reign of God is not only beyond our efforts, it is even beyond our vision. We accomplish in our lifetime only a tiny fraction of the magnificent enterprise that is God's work. Nothing we do is complete, which is another way of saying that God's reign always lies beyond us. No statement says all that could be said. No prayer fully expresses our faith. No confession brings perfection. No pastoral visit brings wholeness. No program accomplishes the church's mission. No set of goals and objectives includes everything. This is what we are about. We plant seeds that one day will grow. We water seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces effects beyond our capabilities. We cannot do everything, and there is a sense of liberation in realizing that. This enables us to do something, and to do it very well. It may be incomplete, but it is a beginning, a step along the way. An opportunity for God's grace to enter and do the rest. We may never see the end results, but that is the difference between the master builder and the worker. We are workers, not master builders, ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future, not our own. Amen. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And if you want to come and look at some of these sheets here, resource things.